Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. Our topic today is marriage, why so many people, young and old, are bypassing it. But let me just note first that the Muslim fast of Ramadan ends tonight. We wish a joyous Eid al-Fitr to those who will be celebrating. And I also want to take a minute to recap the news. This morning at Circuit Court in Baltimore, the highest-ranking police officer charged in the death of Freddie Gray last year, Lieutenant Brian Rice, opted to be tried by a judge rather than a jury. His trial is to begin on Thursday. The most serious charges against Rice stem from failing to secure Gray with his seatbelt when Rice helped load Gray, who was shackled, into the police van. Rice has pleaded not guilty to involuntary manslaughter, second-degree assault, two counts of misconduct in office, and reckless endangerment. He is free on $350,000 bail. Now, to our main topic today, marriage. From destination weddings in the tropics to backyard barbecue celebrations at home, summer is wedding season in America. Although, maybe in your circle of family and friends, you've noticed people are older when they get married or holding off altogether. Today, just half of adults live with a spouse, down from over two-thirds in 1967. And more people than ever report never having been married. A Pew Research Center analysis of 2012 census data found that one in five adults aged 25 and older had never been married. In 1960, merely one in 10 adults in that same age range had never been married. People are older when they get married. In 1950, the median age at first marriage for men was about 24, for women about 22. Today, that age is 29 for men and 27 for women. So people are about 5 years older when they are first married these days. Midday producer Maureen Harvey went to the Baltimore Farmers Market and Bazaar underneath the Jones Falls Expressway this weekend to ask why people are holding off on marriage. Here's what Liz, age 35, had to say.
I think people are more focused on their education and their careers, and so they tend to get that established first or situated first, and then they decide to get married. I don't know. I would say most people at my age or my friends are all in the same boat as me. They're not married, and they're kind of focusing on the career first.
David and Jenny, both 29, had a different take.
It's a good question, because we didn't. We got married young. We've been together since high school.
So I got married at 21.
Yeah, 21, yeah.
But this is our first baby, so we did wait on the baby thing. I guess people are more focused on their careers. What do you think, Dave?
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like people are dating older and just
they don't
waiting.
Want to settle. I think people don't want to settle down. They're always looking for something else.
Yeah, I feel like there is a culture of not wanting to settle and not wanting to be tied down. And I don't know if that's necessarily true.
Do, yeah.
It's a mental state. You don't have to feel that way, but people, it's sort of the way we talk about marriage nowadays.
Lisa and Damian Durant, both in their 40s, been married about 18 years, shared their views on what makes a lasting marriage.
Yeah, I was 30.
I think I was, 24, 25, something
All right,
like
we've
that.
Been married this year, it'll be 17 years. And when we met each other, it was just, we liked all the same things. So we really clicked like that, to like everything. So
I mean, it wasn't easy, you know. It was a long time before it got the way it needed to be. But we lasted and we hung in there.
It's definitely work.
Here we go.
It's work. Marriage is work. People give up after 3 and 5 years, but no. That's just beginning.
So that was Lisa and Damian Durant. We heard last, before that, David and Jenny, and before that, Liz. When did marriage rates start to decline? Is this trend occurring around the world? Does society lose a social good if marriage becomes much less prevalent or even obsolete? What does this mean for kids and parenting? With me in Studio A to discuss Americans' changing views of marriage is Philip Cohen, professor of sociology at the University of Maryland. He writes about gender, race, class, and marriage at his blog, Family Inequality, which can be found at familyinequality.wordpress.com. We'll link to that from the midday page at WIPR.org. Philip Cohen is also author of the textbook, The Family, Diversity, Inequality, and Social Change, published by W.W. Norton. Welcome to Midday.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm very glad that you're with us. So fewer people are married, and people are older when they first get married. What does the marriage rate look like today?
Well, the as you described it, the rising age of marriage is maybe the most pronounced, most visible change from a half a century ago. But it's also slightly misleading. That is, a lot of people get married. The average age has risen to the late 20s, as you say. But really what's also happened is the age at marriage and the transition into marriage has spread out and become more diverse. So that there are still some people marrying younger and some people marrying older. And so it's sort of like we haven't had a change where everybody used to get married at 22 and now they all get married at 27. Instead, the average is being pulled up because the ages are just spreading out. We have more of a diverse a set of pathways into family, what we call family formation. So people are more likely to have children first. They're more likely to come together in some kind of blended family, to have cohabiting relationships that last for a year or several years. As the person that your producer Maureen interviewed said, a lot more interest in pursuing careers and education first before making sort of permanent commitments in marriage. So
let me interrupt on that point. Is that true across the board, this focus on education and career? Is that true in some groups more than others?
Right. Well, among all the people who are going to college or expecting to go to college or finish college, those are the groups that are usually intending to marry after they are done with their education or at least done with their first higher education degree. So you find the people who get married later are more likely to have college degrees, but that may very well be because they were going through college and therefore were postponing their marriages.
Okay. You have observed a racial dimension to the data. Tell us about
it's,
that.
It's actually very dramatic. I mean, in 1950, about 70% of white and black adults were married, if you look at all ages. And now it's fallen to about 50% for whites and a little less than a third for blacks. That's men and women together, all ages. Again, that's a little bit misleading. I mean, that's a huge drop in marriage for everybody. So, but that's partly people just getting married later. So when you look at all adults at any one time, fewer people are married. I did some sort of projections from current data to try to figure out how many people are likely to ever get married. And when you look there, it's about 85% of white women will ever get married compared to about 78% of black women. So it's lower for black women, and we demographers have a sexist history of doing these things just for women, so you have to excuse me.
And hold your thought, but I didn't realize that. Why is it that you look to women to explain the marriage trends?
Well, I think it comes from our historic studies of birth rates and births and fertility, which were always more accurately recorded for women, and so it's just tradition. There's no good reason for it now, and we can do the same thing for men and get very similar results now.
Okay, so you were telling us that it looks, if you do the projections, as if 85% of white women will at some point in their lives be married.
Right, compared to about 78% for black women. But that marriages for black women are much more likely to be later, to be in their 30s, even late 30s and early 40s. That's the first marriage. The experience is quite different, even for people who do eventually end up getting married.
Well, tell us more about some of the factors that are at work here. I mean, I think some people may be listening to this, and by the way, let me say, listeners, you are welcome to be part of this conversation. Do you feel strongly about marriage? Do you think it still matters, or do you agree with some of the voices we heard that, you know, it may not be the first priority anymore? You can join this conversation with Philip Cohn, sociologist from the University of Maryland. You can phone us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. I was starting to say, I think some people are listening to this and saying, well, duh, compared to back in the day when, you know, my grandmother, of course, got married because she wasn't going to have much of a job anyway. But now women have great jobs. So that's why they're not getting married.
Right.
True or false?
I think that is probably the biggest factor. It is not just employment, but really independence for women especially, but for young adults overall, but especially really for women. And that is increased educational opportunities, increased employment opportunities, and the more extended period of young adulthood, or what people sometimes call extended adolescence, just going to college into your 20s and delaying that entry into marriage. I'm not sure that if people are marrying less or marrying later, we should, you know, equate this with a decline in respect or importance of marriage. In some ways, marriage is more important now that it's more often a choice. That is, people elevated in importance in their minds or in the culture because you don't have to. When everybody had to be married, and it was virtually universal half a century ago, or a little bit more, it wasn't something that had the same level of it wasn't personally something that people chose. And so, yes, it was important in the sense that everybody was doing it. But now it's reached the point where people are much more likely to say, this marriage is not, it's not good, it's not working, it's not what I imagine a marriage should be, therefore we're going to divorce. Or we have a vision for marriage which is exalted, and we want to have our marriage take place when we have arrived and we're ready to own a house or a decent place to live, to have good jobs, to provide something for our children, and therefore because of that high view of marriage, we're going to delay marriage. And so that may end up reducing the numbers of married people also, but not because people don't value marriage.
Well, let me take this moment then to try to understand what the relationship of what we've been talking about is to divorce. If it's the case that marriage is better thought out and that people are waiting until they're in a better position to make a good marriage and put and bring resources to it, the divorce rate has fallen, right?
Well, maybe a little. It's definitely much higher than it was in the olden days. The big increase in divorce was really in the 70s, 60s and 70s into about the early 80s sometime when divorce started cooling off quite a bit. It's still definitely much higher than it was then. There's some debate about the methods for figuring out the divorce rate because somebody gets married today, we have no way of knowing their chance of divorcing in the future. Using similar kind of demographic techniques, my projection is it's basically about half of marriages will probably end in divorce unless something changes. So half of people getting married, and that's dramatically higher than it was in the not too distant past. So does that mean that, you know, people are making bad choices about marriage? It's not clear. I think we have to ask what would be the divorce rate in our ideal world. We sometimes treat divorce a little bit like child abuse, you know, like the less the better, right? So everything is better if fewer people are getting divorced. But people change, circumstances change, people make mistakes. You probably want there to be some divorce, even in a perfect world. I don't think we've settled on what the right level is.
We have to take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll pick up just on that point. We'll talk some more about divorce. We'll talk about marriage. We'll talk about having kids in marriage, out of marriage. You're welcome to be part of this conversation. What do you think is going on with marriage? What are you seeing in your own life? What are you seeing among your close friends? Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We're talking about marriage here on Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us.
The divorce rate is so high. I think that people are really taking their time to get, you know, date around, really find the right person, and a lot comes with getting divorced. So I think people are wanting to do that, like not wanting that to happen. So why get married? I mean, I have friends that have been with boyfriends or girlfriends for a really long time and have gotten married, and other friends that are just sort of being 30 and living and kind of rolling with the punches. I think a lot of people look at it being a piece of paper and not anything more than that.
Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. We just heard Kate Hawkins, age 30, sharing her thoughts on why more people today are holding off on marriage. And I'm talking here in the studio with Philip Cohen, sociologist, professor of sociology at the University of Maryland. He writes about gender, race, class, and marriage at his blog, Family Inequality. Philip, we heard from a lot of young people, not just Katie, about divorce. When you ask, why do you think people aren't getting married? Divorce was what they mentioned. Do you pick that up too, that the high dissolution of marriages is part of why people are saying, I don't want to get into that institution?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. The people who are concerned about divorce are more likely to put off marriage, to be more cautious about entering into long-term relationships. So one way we see that is people who have had parents who've gotten divorced are more likely to divorce themselves, and people are worried about that. But also we see among divorced people or people who've been in relationships for a long time and older people who have been divorced, we have a big increase in people living together without marriage, especially even among senior citizens who are more reluctant to enter into marriage, partly because they've been divorced before.
I want to pick up on that, but let's talk to Joe, who is calling us from Catonsville. Joe, welcome to Midday.
Thanks. How are you guys doing today?
Just great. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. I think Kate's comment in the beginning there mirrored a lot of my thoughts on that, but also with what you guys were just talking about with the divorce rates being of concern. I know, for instance, like my wife and I, we were actually engaged once. When we were much younger, and we broke off our engagement because of that, because, my parents had separated and broken up. Her parents were divorcing. There were a lot of different things happening, and we were both sort of in this situation where we were like, you know what, I want to know who I am maybe a little better, and we wanted to give each other an opportunity to grow independently, because, I mean, we were young. We were like 21, 22, and, you know, we actually ended up getting back together when we were about 25, 26, and we ended up getting married when I was 27, and she's 28. And, we've been married for 5 years now, and it's been really good. It's been awesome. So I think, part of it is just that idea of I wanted to make sure I was ready to make that move with another person, and I had to really know who I was in that sense.
And having seen your parents go through divorce made you especially cautious.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it wasn't just the fact that they divorced, but, what you see from the inside, so to speak, whether it's the arguing, the fights, whether it's just not liking each other at times. And you sort of say, I don't want to get in that position, because to me, that was harder for me to deal with than my parents divorcing. There were times my sister and I had that conversation of like, just get it over with,
Gotcha.
But dealing with the other stuff is the things that I didn't want to be in the position of doing with my wife.
Joe, I appreciate your calling and sharing that. Thank you. Is Joe's comment typical?
Yeah, I think his point's very well taken. One way to think about the high divorce rate that people are aware of is it's a kind of uncertainty that hangs over people. But it's only one kind, and in many ways, life is less predictable and more uncertain than it was a few decades ago, and that just makes it difficult for people to make long-term plans and commitments. And we see this in the economic sphere, definitely, where people change careers and jobs more often than they did in the past. In housing, where they may change where they live more often, and in a variety of ways, our lives are less predictable. And when you don't know what the future holds in one arena, it's very hard to make a commitment in another. You wouldn't want to pick your job and make a lifetime commitment to it before you know what your college major is going to be, right? In the same way, it's difficult to make a commitment in marriage before you know what career you're going to have or how long you're going to spend in school. And so the uncertainty in one realm translates into cautiousness in others.
How often do people who got divorced get remarried?
I wish I could give you a number from that off the top of my head, but I will say remarriage is quite common. The sociologist Andrew Cherlin likes to point out that Americans love marriage so much they do it over and over again. I mean, and we have a lot of remarriage, and a lot of the
one of the factors that actually contributes to divorce is remarriage, ironically, because second marriages are more complicated. So even if one person has been married before and the other one hasn't, sometimes you have children, the relationships are just more complicated and they're harder to manage. In addition, you have the previous relationship that may still be casting an influence. So remarriages are pretty common, and they also have a very high divorce rate.
That is Philip Cohen of the University of Maryland. He's a sociologist, and expert on families, inequality, and marriage. We're talking about marriage in America. You can be part of this conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Elena has called us from Baltimore. Elena, welcome to Midday.
Yes. I was wondering about the role of culture in marriage, because it seems that with certain ethnic groups, there is a perception that they're not open to others outside that group, and so people are not going to approach them. So, for example, if you're assuming that, you know, a person must stick with somebody if you are unable to communicate with somebody's immigrant grandparents, then perhaps you might be less likely to ask that person out. Also, specifically, from my culture, there's been many Black women in the past who have said that they were only interested in Black men. And so even though that is not the case to the same degree, and a lot of people have changed their ideas about that, there's still a barrier, because people want success, and if they think they're going to be shot down, they're less likely to try.
Elena, interesting questions. Thank you for putting them on the table. Philip Cohen, how would you respond to those?
I think Elena's point is really well taken. The situation for Black women in particular is unique in several ways. Black women do have a very low rate of intermarriage, that is, of marrying people who are not marrying men, we're talking about, who are not also Black. There may be preferences on both sides and the cautiousness that Elena describes. But given that low rate of intermarriage, it's also really relevant that there is, demographically speaking, such a shortage of single Black men. And you can look at this in a variety of ways, whether it's literally living men, because Black men have a higher mortality rate than other groups in their young ages, in their teens and 20s. But also, if you're going to set some kind of standard for who you might want to marry, sort of criteria for marriageability. If you look at single men with a job who are not incarcerated, who've never been incarcerated, maybe, the numbers get to be quite skewed in the Black community in particular. And so one of the studies I've done looks at the at specific metropolitan areas and the ratio of single men to women within racial groups. And Black women have the worst single person sex ratios you can find out there. And it's actually also worse with higher levels of education. And in most metropolitan areas, it's about 2-to-1 single Black women to single Black men among college graduates, a little bit better for those who aren't college graduates. But given those low rates of intermarriage, that smaller number of single men who are sort of available, if you will, in the marriage market, that really drives down the marriage rate or extends the period of being single for Black women in particular.
Elena particularly asked about the role of culture in sort of making these choices, and I realize that you're an expert in the macro data, in the demographics, but do you have a sense of whether those signals get, I mean, if there's somebody in a group who isn't necessarily looking just in that group, how do those signals get passed? Do you have an idea about that?
Well, it's a difficult subject, and it's hard to we can look at some specific situations where you might expect to see, say, less racism or discrimination or weaker sort of cultural barriers between groups. In my book, I discuss one study that was done among college students at Stanford University. So all elite students, all with a very bright future, away from their parents who might be casting a watchful eye on their choices. And overwhelmingly, people dated within their race and ethnic group, especially the African-Americans, especially women. I really don't think – I would not put that – that's the skewed numbers on sort of the choices or the preferences of Black women per se. I mean, I think the the discrimination against Black women in our society is extreme in some ways, especially as far as value judgments and that sort of the judgmentalness against Black women is very strong. So, you know, it's I can say that much without being, you know, a culture expert.
I want to then connect that to having kids. Right. You mentioned a few minutes ago that we've been talking about lower numbers and later people getting married less and getting married later. But that's getting married. You said cohabitation is actually up. Is it up enough to compensate? I mean, are we having a big conversation when what's happening is people are foregoing the ceremony and foregoing the legal status, but they're still essentially coupling up as they always have?
Well, yes and no. They are coupling up. They're certainly coupling up sexually as much as they always have. And then living together is sort of a higher level of commitment, and marriage is really a higher level. It's not the case that cohabitation is replacing marriage in the sense of creating a new kind of permanent but just not technically legally married situation. Cohabiting relationships tend to be much shorter lived, more unstable, and just less likely to be long-term committed relationships. So it is true that a lot of people look single in the data, but they are actually living with somebody or have a long-term or medium-term partner. But it's not the same as marriage. On the children thing, you know, the age of marriage has risen faster than the age of childbearing, which has risen also. But we have a lot more people, and here we'll talk about women because that's what we have the data for, and because children usually live with them when they're not married. We have a lot more women having children before they're married. And that's partly biological. That is, if the age of marriage keeps going up,
you can't push off having kids.
Right. Just sort of biologically to have children, but also to be healthy and young and vibrant, and to have a healthy a mother or grandmother who's going to help you, and for all the things that people want in their parenting relationships. You know, there's reasons to do that earlier, and so that's certainly one of the clashes in the data that we have is the rising age of marriage, but children still being born at younger ages.
Well, how would you as a demographer address, I mean, is it the case that to some large degree that I'll let you describe that Americans are separating the decisions to have kids and the decisions to be in an ongoing relationship?
Yes, I think that's a fair generalization. They're certainly much more separated than they used to be. So in this sort of a period when we had the most universal marriage in the 50s, it was very uncommon to have children before marriage or outside of marriage. And now it's really quite common. And so marriage, which has become more of an emotional, an individual relationship between adults, has become separated from childbearing in a lot of ways. Now, married people and unmarried couples still are parents and co-parents, and they parent their children together. But it's much less often in the marriage relationship, and that's a big change for both parenting and for marriage.
Brooke has called us from Ellicott City. Brooke, welcome to Midday.
Hello.
Hello, Brooke. You're on the air.
It's funny because I actually have a blog called Preferred Single Status. and I just find all of this conversation about marriage so interesting because one of the things that became a question for me, and I'm a 52-year-old Black woman, so you're talking about the circumstances surrounding Black women was also particularly interesting to me. But having been married and divorced and in multiple relationships, I finally came to this space where I was like, why do we continue to pursue coupling relationships at all, much less marriage? It's like we have this sort of societal norm where the thing is to pursue to be a part of a couple, and being single isn't necessarily an option or a consideration. People always look at you like, oh, you just haven't met the right one yet, or if you change this thing about yourself, or if you look for these qualities in the other person, then you too can be a part of this thing called couple. And it's but the idea and the freedom and the option of actually choosing to be single, it doesn't even seem to exist if that makes any sense.
Brooke, I appreciate you calling. I've heard about a book that I have not read, and I don't know the name of the author, called All the Single Ladies. Mm-hmm. I think there are more people focusing on exactly what you are, and I'm going to restrain my urge to tell you all the good things about being coupled up, and I'm going to ask sociologist Philip Cohen to address your point.
Yes, I recommend the book, All the Single Ladies, by Rebecca, I want to say Traister, but it might just be Traister. Really sorry.
We will look it up.
Follow
and
her on Twitter and see
tell
her
you
tweets
after
all
this
the time,
next
but
break.
I forgot. There's another book called Going Solo by the sociologist Eric Kleinenberg, who talks a lot about the single impulse and the rise of living alone in modern society. And I think, Brooke, I think your comments are very well taken. I mean, there are different kinds of freedom in play here, and they're somewhat contradictory. Rebecca Traister, that's it. Okay, good. Thank you. The different kinds of freedom are at play here. One, you know, if you have a long-term commitment, that gives you one kind of freedom. For example, the freedom to experiment, to make changes in your lifestyle, to change jobs or take time off from work or things that you can do with the security of knowing that the other person is there to back you up. Right. On the other hand, of course, the freedom of being single is a different kind of freedom, is the freedom to not have that set of burdens and obligations that do come from marriage or any kind of long-term commitment. So I do think it's valuable to consider the pros and cons that go in both ways. And it does get back to that point of uncertainty in life. And the idea of tying oneself down to a long-term commitment in the absence of predictability and all the other aspects of life just seem increasingly disjointed to people. It doesn't resonate with a lot of people like Brooke, apparently.
Brooke, I appreciate your calling. We need to take another quick break here. And when we come back, one of the things I'd like to talk about is a year ago, the Supreme Court struck down state bans on same-sex marriage. I wonder whether this decision had any impact on marriage rates. You can be part of our conversation. You can tell us what marriage means to you and what how you look at this trend. Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about marriage. I'm speaking with University of Maryland sociologist Philip Cohen. We're talking about fewer people getting married and people getting married later and what's going on with divorce. You can be part of this conversation. Why do you think that the economic stability associated with marriage seems to be less of an incentive today? Are you a millennial? How do you view marriage? You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org, or you can phone us at 410-662-8780. Craig has called us from Hunt Valley. Craig, welcome to Midday.
Thanks very much. Good to be on.
Yeah. Your thoughts?
So my comment was that I was talking to my sister about this over the July 4th weekend, and we both have children that are married. We were talking about we're both originally from Maine. She was in New York, and I live down here, and we were talking about how there's an increased strain on marriages these days, given the changes in rich family distance. You know, we don't live close to each other, but we grew up with families that all lived around each other. So about how that change affects the stress that we feel on our marriages and what we expect of marriages. We have this unrealistic expectation of what marriage can do for somebody and how it sustains us and all the things it's supposed to be able to do for us individually. And, just wondering if we could hear some comments about how the change in the societal relationship between extended families versus, you know, just smaller families, and then the mobility, especially of millennials now, how that's affected the strain that exists on marriages, and then people's reaction to wanting to get married because they feel like it's such a lofty endeavor, noble goal. It's got all these things attached to it. It has to fulfill you, the old, you know, you complete me. From the old movie line.
Interesting points, Craig. Thank you. Thank you for calling. Philip Cohen, how would you address this question of whether we just expect too much from the institution of marriage, so it's bound to disappoint?
Well, I think that's a really interesting point. And I mean, we in some ways, marriage does less than it used to
I'm sort of functionally. And one of the issues, like Craig mentions, is the relationship with our older parents and relatives. It's less often the case now that people are expecting to live with and take care of their older relatives as part of the marriage, sort of the married family experience. That rising independence I talked about with women has really affected older people also. So, you know, people over 65 are much more likely to live independently than they used to. And so that, you know, in some ways that lifts a source of stress from a lot of marriages. But on the other point about rising expectations, one of the things we see is the rising investment, you could say, or expense spending on weddings and the high level of symbolism that people put on that. I mean, the person we had the clip from earlier who said marriage is just a piece of paper. Well, you know, a paycheck is just a piece of paper too, but it carries great importance in its implications for how people act. And so when people are planning weddings, a lot of time they'll delay their marriage or forego marriage altogether, partly because they can't afford the send-off that they expect, because they want a wedding to symbolize that they have arrived somewhere, not that they are starting off somewhere. And so it's a very high expectation. And besides just literally the expense of it, the emotional expectation of wanting to do it perfectly reflects sort of that tension between we value marriage in some ways more and more, and on the other hand, it's not as essential as it used to be. So if it can't be perfect, we may let it go.
Yeah, I was struck. We heard that from Maureen, our producer Maureen Harvey, heard that from quite a few of the young people she spoke with, that the expense of a wedding seemed ridiculous. And there was, obviously a wedding is one way to get into marriage, so they rejected the whole institution of marriage. I want to raise another question. Let's hear Maureen talk with Sean McDermott, who's 52 years old.
People just need more time after school, after finishing college, get settled in their careers. With the economy, things are a little tougher in terms of starting out early, at an early age in a marriage. So I think most people feel they need more time just to get settled financially. Yeah, a lot of my friends, I'm gay, and with marriage being legal now, you know, a lot of my friends have taken that step to get married, whereas in the past we haven't been able to. So I'm seeing more people my age who are gay, you know, taking that step.
So Sean's remarks focus on the fact that we're talking about these trends over years of fewer people getting married, and yet we had this huge focus as a society in the last few years about a group that very much wanted to be in on this institution and a lot of people supporting them in that. And I'm wondering whether the legalization of gay marriage can be seen in the demographics you study, in the data you study. Has there been an increase in people getting married because of that?
Well, the short answer is yes, but probably not enough to make a big mark on these differences, on these trends that we've been seeing over time. I think the point that that is very well taken, that we had this huge focus on marriage. And it's ironic, it's a time when really sort of left and right in the political spectrum could all agree that marriage is extremely important, with on the one side a group of people saying marriage is a right and people should have access to this institution and the protections and recognition that it affords. On the other hand, people saying marriage is a traditional bastion, it has a historic meaning and should not be changed and altered in some casual way. But what they both had in common was marriage is extremely important. I think in the long run, we're probably not going to see gay and lesbian couples have much different marriage rates than everybody else, and they're facing the same situation. And especially this issue, one thing that struck me in that comment was the idea of being settled in their careers. I'd really like to see if I could date that historically. It's difficult to do, but when did it become essential to be settled in your career before marriage? That certainly was not the case in 1950, when the assumption was you would get married before you even started your career.
And the two of you together would get settled.
Right, exactly. So it was a settling process that would happen within marriage, and now it's much more before. And I think that partly goes—
Well, when did that— You ask when. You're the expert. You tell me. When
did this— Sometime between 1960 and 1990, you know, somewhere in there.
I mean, is there any other trend that you point to that triggered that?
I think it goes back to women's independence in a way. And if you think about it, you know, marriage was really not voluntary before. And it was an exalted space, but also very problem. I mean, it was not rape within marriage was not even illegal in most places until the 70s. I mean, it just was not that space within marriage was totally sort of separated off in a way that some people look on in, you know, in a positive way, but also was like a prison for a lot of people. So now we have this situation where people can freely enter and choose this relationship and make this commitment from really a position of strength. Here I'm mostly speaking about women in a way that they could not before. And all my students, all my college students, my women in my family classes at Maryland and the other places I've taught, they all say they want to finish their education and start their careers before they get married. And I think it's because they want to enter it from a position of strength. I think they want to have a strong negotiating position. They want to be in a position to meet and attract the right people and enter into it after they individually are already sort of established.
Mike is calling us from Sparks with something to say about this issue and how it plays out in other societies. Mike, welcome to Midday.
I think your guest just stole my thunder. Actually, I think you're absolutely right in that the liberation of women. I mean, if you look back for millennia, you know, women had one choice in life, and that was to be a mother over and over and over again. And not to disparage that, but there were really no other options. And as that changed, and I think the 1960 to 1990 time frame fits perfectly with the sexual revolution, the introduction of the pill, there became this the notion of that you have a choice other than being a mother. That a lot of women said, having five or seven or nine children, which was not unusual, six decades ago. Women are saying, gee, there's so much out there in the world that I'd like to experience or that I'd like to do. And so family sizes are smaller. They're starting later. And I think it has everything to do with the liberation of women. If you look at your immigration populations in Europe, for example, where they're coming from very, very traditional societies, and they have multiple children typically, but the very first generation that's brought up in the European countries typically have family sizes not very dissimilar from the native European. So you have this.
Mike, our time is growing short, and I do want to pick up with Philip Cohen on this question of how this looks around the world that you're getting us to. Are we seeing the trend that you've been describing to us in America worldwide? Thank you, Mike, for the call.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. Short answer is yes, it really depends on where you are. I mean, in Asia, for example, China and India, which is half the world almost by themselves, marriage is still almost universal, although it's happening later, at later ages, which in India may mean the late teens. But almost all parts of the world are going in the direction of later or less marriage. What is interesting also is this issue of the conservativeness of marriage traditionally. I think there's some hybrid situations. If you look, for example, at Korea or Taiwan, a couple of East Asian societies where they have norms of individual freedom emerging and legal freedom for individuals, and yet marriage is still very traditional. So women are getting more education, have more career opportunities, and yet when they enter into marriage, it becomes sort of shrouded in this traditional set of behaviors. For example, men do very little housework and childcare. So in those situations, what we're seeing is a real delay in marriage. So women especially are delaying their marriages almost as long as they can into their late 20s or early 30s. Because they know that when they eventually get married, it sort of brings will bring the hammer down, and they'll end up in an old style traditional relationship that they may not want. So it really creates a contradiction in those situations, and I think it can't really last.
So what does the decline in marriage rates mean for families and for their economic stability?
Well, the economic argument for marriage has always been that when you like contracts in the economy generally, when you make a commitment, it increases your predictability. You can make long term plans and investments. You can, for example, take a year off to invest in some training and not worry that you're going to end up just losing income and so on. And then you also have economies of scale. You know, two people sharing one refrigerator and one car or whatever may be more efficient. And then there also are the effects of marriage on people's behavior. The fact that other people are relying on you may make people, especially men, behave more responsibly. That may not have to happen within marriage, but the idea of having people depend on you may make people, for example, focus on their career advancement more than other kinds of ambitions. So it's really a challenge. It's a challenge for our economy and our welfare state to think about how can we ensure the well-being of people who do not have the two-person marriages that we can't assume those that people have that to back them up economically speaking, and especially their children. But we've been going in that direction for a long time. I mean, I think the introduction of Social Security for retirement for older people, the education system, we've been making investments in people to make them less reliant for their survival on their family for a long time. And that in the long run, that's an important part of modern society.
Right, but it's also something people worry about. I mean, if we're creating public services and public structures as if no one has a family or a spouse to rely on or to share the coping with, then that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, doesn't it?
Yes, there's definitely a dynamic there, and it's not. And there's a downside and an upside to that. I mean, the upside is people can act according to their own ambitions and desires individually, and with more freedom than they could in the past. The downside is the possibility of dependence and the greater expense from state institutions in caring for them or their children. So it's a complicated set of trade-offs, and I think the important thing to realize is we can't build our policies around the assumption that everybody and their parents are going to be married forever. I mean, if we do that, we're going to leave a lot of people out and put a lot of people at risk for real hardship.
Well, you created a graph that I looked at that showed that if the drop in marriage continues at the rate it's going, that in 2042 there will be no one getting married. Now, you said that doesn't tend to happen.
I almost lost my demography license for that. Yes.
Because people don't tend to crash into a 0 or 100% of anything you said. But what do you see mediating this, if anything?
Well,
how close to zero are we going to get?
Well, it is interesting. If you draw that line from 1950 to the present, it certainly is going straight down on a strong diagonal down towards zero. It seems very unlikely we'll end up with no marriage. But I think it is likely that we're going to end up with a lower level of marriage permanently than we ever had before. And I think the question is, how are we going to manage that world where it's not permanent for many, possibly most people, and a large number of people never enter into marriage at all?
What an interesting conversation. I wish we had more time. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Philip Cohen, professor of sociology at the University of Maryland. You can read more about gender, race, class, and marriage at his blog, Family Inequality, familyinequality.wordpress.com. Philip Cohen is author of the textbook, The Family, Diversity, Inequality, and Social Change. Also, thanks to Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. And thank you for listening. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about how to buy a new or used car. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned now for Out of the Blocks.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.